On Friday, stocks added to last week's gains, with the Dow Jones Industrials picking up over 100 points on better-than-expected economic numbers. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak. It's great to be back with you this weekend with a brand new show packed with must-hear info and interviews, including top guests and the market headlines affecting your portfolio. First up this weekend, Harry S. Dent Jr., a favorite of the show. Gold is poised to rally back to $1,360, he says, an ounce, and perhaps much higher on restructuring of debt and assets on a massive scale. Plus, equities may have seen their best this year, he thinks, with only about a 5% upside potential, but nearly 65% downside. And then housing may be overvalued significantly. Patience will be rewarded with bargain prices. And then the silver investor, David Morgan, thinks that the silver market bottom is in place, but people should avoid the temptation to try to catch the exact bottom. Instead, dollar cost averaging into silver positions makes the most sense in anticipation of a big move. His Elliott Wave work shows a parabolic advance could unfold as soon as 2015 to 2016. And silver's current nominal value is at least $35 an ounce. That's over $15 above the current price, making nearly a 100% increase, a solid opportunity here. Then GoldSeek.com wraps up with Robert Ian's latest report. And a brief moment of silence in memory of a good friend of the show who helped guide us in the early days, and a really good friend of Bob Chapman's. Mr. Ho and his wife lived in Anaheim, California. If you'd be so kind as to imagine your favorite Grateful Dead song playing in the background, due to copyright issues, we just can't do that anymore. But I think it would put a smile on his face. Well, farewell to you, Mr. Ho, and we wish you the very best during these difficult times, Mrs. Ho. Bob Chapman, Michael Rupert, and many other mentors of ours are also sorely missed and remembered fondly. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the Market Weather Report. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the gold market. Some profit-taking was seen amid geopolitical concerns. Still, the 2014 bullion rally continues to defy bearish forecasts from Goldman Sachs experts, topping the gains in most equities, bonds, and commodities. For the third week running, the U.S. dollar rally failed to overcome resistance. It's really quite a sight to see. If you pull up a weekly chart of $USD at stockcharts.com, you'll see the U.S. dollar has failed at three attempts back-to-back to blast over resistance. You just don't see this every week. You know, one has to wonder if it's due to all of the renewed geopolitical tensions. The news potentially set the stage for a forceful precious metals rebound. At Friday's closing rally on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was only off $4, finishing at $1,306, still higher for the year by over 5%. Silver lost only 40 cents, finishing at $19.52, and palladium blasted higher by 33. Talk about bucking the trends, up to nearly $900, $894 to be exact, on supply disruption concerns. You know, given those tensions between the West and Russia and these ridiculous economic reprisals and sanctions placed on Russia, which is still the world's leading supplier of palladium. So folks, keep an eye on this. This is an interesting development, particularly given that platinum was off $18. We usually see them not move exactly in lockstep, but platinum and palladium are closely aligned. And yes, Russia is a major producer of platinum, but not nearly as much so as South Africa. So the big story here is palladium is signaling to folks, keep an eye on Russia and Ukraine. Platinum was off nearly 20, closing at $14.59 an ounce on the NYMEX. And West Texas Intermediate crude finished at the break-even point for the week, ending at $97.35 a barrel. The top story driving the markets this week, several global hotspots continue to keep investors on the edge of their seats, including skirmishes in Gaza, Ukraine, and Iraq. This week, Ukraine announced an attack on an armed convoy that crossed apparently the border from Russia. Nevertheless, a Russian official retorted that the convoy was on a humanitarian mission and reiterated pleas for a ceasefire. Elsewhere, billionaire hedge fund manager John Paulson is holding on to his Spider Gold Trust holding, the biggest ETF in the sector. Paulson and company hold the largest in the biggest ETF. That's a 10.2 million shares for the fourth quarter running as of July 30th. That's according to an SEC filing. Paulson began accumulating shares back in 2009 early, citing record monetary stimulus. However, the Fed has reduced its monthly bond purchasing program down to $25 billion as of January 30th, marking the sixth consecutive $10 billion cut, while holding lending rates near zero. Interestingly, Paulson added to holdings in Agnico Eagle Mines, a favorite of our late and dear friend Bob Chapman, and he continues to hold a position in NovaGold Resources. Now, fellow billionaire George Soros also added a position in the mining sector, Barrick Gold Corp., the largest producer, and he recently added the Market Vectors Gold Mining ETF as well. In related news, Paul Singer manages $24.8 billion at Elliott Management Corp. He recently told investors that gold represents a unique and inexpensive opportunity given the increase in inflation expectations. And speaking of holding gold, China and India together account for about half of the global gold demand. They've purchased 193 tons and 204 tons of gold, respectively, in the second quarter. In fact, the World Gold Council now is calling for India and China to purchase, now hold on to your hats, 4 million pounds of gold this year. India buying about 1,000 tons of gold and China over 1,000 tons. If you do the math, 1,000 tons is 2 million pounds. Multiply that times two, well, there you are. The Indian Prime Minister Modi reduced the stringent gold import rules recently, but he's yet to repeal it entirely. So if the trend continues, we can expect further buying from India to boost global gold demand. Central bankers are not shy when it comes to their purchases. They've added 118 tons of gold in the second quarter. That's a 28% boost over last year, topping the list Russia and Kazakhstan in an attempt to dilute exposure to U.S. dollar reserves. Well, precious metals, bottom line. The technical picture improved this week with the U.S. dollar failing to rally despite three attempts. Plus, global uncertainty continues to keep investors on their toes, including the impending Argentine default and seasonal factors improving with holiday-related jewelry demand just around the corner. So be sure to log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account for next week's market forecast and for all the stock picks. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors piled into shares on relatively tame unemployment figures from the Labor Department. More jobs typically translates into improved consumer spending and corporate profits, boosting earnings and share prices. For the week, the Dow added 108 points, finishing at 1666. The S&P 500 was up 24 points, wrapping up at 1944, while the NASDAQ added 94 points, coming close to a new record high at 4464. Well, although U.S. jobless claims rose more than expected, it was essentially a drop in the bucket, with jobless rates only higher by less than 10%, up about 21,000 to 311,000 total. Despite naysayers, the U.S. economy continues to impress, approaching a near Goldilocks-like scenario. The V8 economy is firing on all eight cylinders, making conditions just right for profits and shares. Well, the solid job market, higher consumer spending, corporate earnings growth, it all continues to reward investors while much of the herd remain on the sidelines, still a bit gun-shy following that harrowing 2008 stock market swoon. In fact, one could say that conditions should be less impressive given the number and severity of geopolitical concerns. Nonetheless, manufacturing conditions softened in August, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The Empire State's business conditions index fell to 14.69 in August, down from 25.6, much lower than expected. Still, industrial production climbed 0.4%. That was twice the expected number. Several stocks powered forward, including Seabridge Gold, blasted higher, a gold-seek advertiser. Coca-Cola was up almost 2%. On news of a big purchase of shares in Monster Beverage Corp., MNST, which blasted itself by over 30% on the news Friday. Gannett Corp. added nearly 2%. Shares flew higher on news that Carl Icahn had accumulated nearly a 7% stake in the company, according to the SEC filing. Well, bottom line on Wall Street, this week's stocks rallied as forecasted in the last report. Still, some pundits seem to be overlooking a key ingredient to the U.S. equities rally, the fact that trouble is brewing in Europe's periphery and lackluster regional output makes the U.S. all the more appealing to the rest of the world. And the seven-component index remains near a three-week low. This is a positive sign. Given this week's market strength, it just means that folks are still nervous, and that tends to be good for rallies. And did you know that we've entered an interesting time in human history? For one of the first times, perhaps in thousands of years, it's actually less costly to be animal-friendly. You can purchase clothes, as I've mentioned in the past, belts, shoes, wallets. You can now have, in synthetic form, it's just as comfortable, sometimes even more so. Crocs makes all types of shoes that are just made out of synthetics. Plus, there's other companies like Nunbush, which make fantastic shoes. Put the links up recently for our alpha subscribers if you're interested. Why take the life of an animal when you just don't have to? No one knows the difference. This isn't for everybody, but if you share my sentiments and you realize it's even less costly in most cases for Amazon.com, just go animal friendly. How many times in history could you get just as much protein from, you know, wonderful beans and lentil soups and things like minestrones with pasta thrown in? Really, no need for animal products. Impress your friends, start a new trend. Even if you just reduce the animal intake in your life, not only will you feel better physically, probably increase your longevity and quality of life, save money, and save a life. Let me know what you think. I'm all ears. You can get me at gsr@hughes.net or gsradio@frontier.com. Well, coming up after the break, more Gold Seek with this week's top guests, David Morgan and Harry S. Dent Jr. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at Gold Seek. Gold closed at a four-week high last week on geopolitical concerns, particularly in the Ukraine area. It's precious metals back on the radar screen, recapturing investors' attention. Who better to have on the show than the silver investor? David Morgan writes the Morgan Report, runs silverinvestor.com, will soon be republishing his book. Welcome, David Morgan.
Well, thank you, Chris. Great to be with you.
David, we're going to get more into this interesting book of yours at the end of the show, but I just kind of wanted to put that teaser out there, give people an idea. Any publishing dates come to mind in the next 6 months, 12 months?
It's called the deadline, and those are important. And of course, we've never missed a deadline on the Morgan Report ever. I'm shooting to have a rough draft for the Money Show, which is in a couple of weeks, and that'll just be like a rough edit. It's like my third revision. But I really want to have it, you know, neat, tidy, and ready, you know, published by the Silver Summit this year, which is October, I think, 23rd, 2014. So say, you know, middle of October or so, we should have it done. So it's going to be a big, powerful, all-inclusive book this time, much more in-depth than Get the Skinny on Silver Investing, which the publisher had certain rules, you know, 100 pages, no graphs, no charts, all that. This we're self-publishing. And it'll have a lot in it, not only about the silver market, but basically the background, the why and the wherefores and the reasons behind the financial crisis or currency crisis that I and others have so long forecast. So that's a bit of a teaser as well, but I know you have a lot of questions to start with, so we should probably move on to those.
Well, I'm sure the gold and silver crowd will devour this upcoming edition with a relish. We will give more juicy details out to the listeners at the end of the show. Let's get into gold and silver. Gold still up about 5-6% for the year. Fantastic. Doing great. Silver still treading water near the break-even level. Not so bad when you consider the volatility factor there. Why don't you tell folks about this disconnect we've seen recently? Maybe some gold premium with the geopolitical concerns in the Middle East, Ukraine, and of course the Argentina currency drama. I'm sure that's a big factor.
I think you touched on it, Chris. Basically, gold is much more mainstream, even though, you know, certainly not a Wall Street darling by any stretch of the imagination, but gold is almost presentable to most investors. I mean, it's known as a crisis hedge, as a safe haven. And those are respectable terms around the gold market. Silver is sort of the poor cousin of gold. It is a safe haven. It does have a monetary status, but it also has an industrial quality. I'll never, you know, say anything different than that. So gold is more likely to move on geopolitical upheavals, et cetera, as you stated. And I think that's why you're seeing more strength in the gold market than the silver market. The deal with silver is it's such a small market that it tends to move both directions faster than gold. So gold starts to get some real momentum here because of, let's call it, safe haven status or a risk-on trade. Silver will rapidly, that'll spill over to the silver market, and because it's cheaper and it's a market that, that especially fund managers, a lot of people like to move into rapidly. So it could all of a sudden outperform gold quite easily. So my take is what you said. We're going to see more and more gold money move into gold kind of slowly, hesitantly. I mean, really, if you think about it, fundamentally, there should be a pretty big move into gold right now with all that's going on geopolitically. But right now, there isn't relative to what the price action is. As far as what the physical movements are, they're hard to get an absolute accurate analysis on. Koos Jansen probably does as good as anybody. There's several analysts that do a good job. Obviously, tons of gold are moving into Asia. That's unabated, although you have seen a couple of recent months come out where, you know, the gold trade is off, meaning substantially less imports for a month. I don't think a day makes a market, and I don't think a month makes a market. Overall, the move from gold from west to east continues. Regardless, I think it's going to take a gold move before you see silver. So that's my take on it right now. You know, August is historically the bottom month for gold. I just did an update for our members. There's a seasonality trade, actually, in silver that works about 80-85% of the time, August 15th through about March of the following year, just going along with the silver market. But I looked at gold this time, and I just, again, did the video for our members, and I do these videos for the Basic Plus service. And gold from the 6th, which we're behind that by, what, about a week, I guess, from the 6th of August up to about February of the following year, so February 2015, has about an 80-85% probability of making new money as well. And that trade I actually established on the 6th is already up, you know, a fair amount, enough to count your money. So I went ahead and for trading purposes, education purposes, said, okay, I'm going to go long at the market today at a stop just under the $1,300 level. So I'm going about a long way, winded way of saying that I really think the bottom is here, but I know there's a lot of others out there in my peer group that thinks that there's going to be another washout, or, you know, we're going to get clobbered, or the traders are showing this or that, and that type of thing. So you probably want to ask me something about that, I'm guessing, but that may be the case.
And I think there is a lot of pessimism. That's another big plus. When you talk about the propensity for silver to outperform gold, there's no better recent illustration than the 2010-2011 period from, let's say, $15-$16 to nearly $50. We're talking a threefold, okay, 200%, but threefold. So let's say you had $10,000. At the peak, you had $30,000. We don't see that type of action in gold. Now, that's not to say we won't. Silver, if you'll recall, was one of the most boring markets for almost 2 years, from 2009 to 2010. People had just given up. Gold just kept running from 2008, 2009. It looked like it was going, never going to stop. And silver just sat there. I mean, it was one of the oddest disconnects. And, you know, we're starting to see a disconnect like that now. People are sick of it. They don't want to hear about it. Think of the discount from $50 to $20. I mean, talk about a relative contrarian value.
Absolutely, Chris. I want to go back and say, you know, on that big run, you know, I established this intermediate level service I have called Basic Plus, and at the $19 level, I said if it broke through, I'm going long. And I rode that to 26, got out and got right back in, rode all the way to 48 and got out within about 3 or 4 days to the top. So I actually had a couple of people that are in the field, so to speak. One is, I won't even say anymore because I don't want people guessing who it was. But this guy retired. I mean, that one trade. Now, I'm not suggesting anyone trade futures. In fact, I actually suggest most people stay as far away from it as they possibly can. But what it does illustrate that if you know what you're doing and you want to put on a position trade and ride it all the way up, it can make up for a lot of mistakes. That was something that we did. You know, I wish I could say we do that every year or on and on. But what I can say is that was established as a remarkable move, as you said, as backing you up. And, you know, I was really concerned with everyone, public and private, meaning people that are members of the website, and anyone out there that's involved in the silver market, because there was so much enthusiasm. And anything around a 35 level on up, I was highly suggesting in the public domain to, you know, be careful. If you have to buy silver, don't buy it all, you know, just buy some and that type of thing. Yet, you know, I just got a letter, an email recently, about, you know, I'm sick of this. I bought all my silver at 40. Now I understand everything there's to know about silver. It's never, ever going to go above 20. And, you know, prove to me why I'm wrong, Mr. Expert. You know, and I actually did send him a private message, and I did say, basically I said, read my book, but I gave him some other tidbits. And, you know, not that I am the end all be all in the silver market. I certainly have put my time and dues into this market, continue to do so. And I use the silver guru moniker as kind of a tongue in cheek thing, as something to remember me by. And I just picked it as a name I could get people to, you know, come to the Hotmail account. When I started, I didn't even have a website. I just had the Hotmail address. But anyway, back on point, it will do that again. And people, there'll be more silver purchase, Chris, above $35 an ounce than there was between this $20 and $35 level. People will not buy bottoms. And it really drives me crazy. I try to find out and ask myself, what can I do differently? What can I say differently? What can I publish? What can, you know, and it's crazy because you look at, you know, people that, let's say, I'll just say it as I see it, that complain. And they complain about, you know, why this or that happens and why the rich get richer and that kind of thing. And it's funny because you look at who bought silver at a bottom. It was Warren Buffett, bought it at the all-time inflation-adjusted low. George Soros, who I'm no big fan of, but he had a major interest in Apex Silver Mines, which is now defunct. And Bill Gates bought a rather substantial position. For him, it was probably just a little drop in the bucket. And he was using one of probably several fund managers that he associates with to put a nice big fat chunk into Pan American Silver. So the billionaires, not the millionaires, the billionaires are buying silver at the bottom. Well, this, as far as I'm concerned, is another bottom. Now, it could go lower, could get a spike low, we could see, you know, something breached, I'll go on. I'll say, I won't give the name, but talk to a PhD, very bright guy, had about a two-hour conversation with him, and you got to keep my interest for me to talk to anybody that long. But he'd done some algorithms, and he's pretty convinced that there's going to be a spike low in silver, gold's going to kind of hold, and the ratio is going to get back to 80 to 1. For the record, I doubt it. But I'm not going to say he's wrong. I'm way too smart, way too seasoned, and the silver market can surprise even me to say that's not, you know, not going to happen. I don't think it will. I really don't. I think the probability of that is probably less than 15%. So for the record, that's where I'm standing. Will it happen? I doubt it. Is it impossible to happen? No. Probability is very low. However, if that were to happen, if you had any guts, and it takes guts in the silver market, you certainly want to load the boat, because those type of spike lows, and I've seen them over and over again. In fact, I wrote an article in Futures Magazine called Spiked, and it was all about these spike lows in the silver market. That's when you want to get on. Problem is, most people can't, because it's a one-day or hourly event. Unless you're sitting there at a computer watching it, the chance of getting in are almost impossible. So you'll see a spike low, and then it'll come up and close much higher that same day. But anyway, I think I said enough on the topic. The best thing for most people is take a long-term view. Don't try to buy the bottom. Don't look for the spike low. Just keep buying at a certain range, and certainly a good range right now. You know, once you get, if you accumulated what you want, say 10% of your overall portfolio by the time, you know, such and such a time, or by the time silver's under 25, I think if you've got a 2, 3, 4 year time horizon, you're going to be very happy you did such.
I think it's an excellent strategy. You know, this idea that you have to catch the absolute bottom, that's the most expensive trade you'll ever make. You know, the tops and the bottom, more money's lost, I think, at those points than anywhere else. And I thought it was interesting that you say that investors simply can't buy bottoms. You know, you'd think that's where the interest would come in, but they lose enthusiasm. It really requires the bull trend, I think, to pull in people where the excitement starts to build in these markets. My guess is you're keeping an eye on, well, there's several factors going on. I mean, other than geopolitical, is there anything else that you'd like to hone in on here?
Looking at, you know, the new uses of silver, which always continue, and one of them is the solid-state lighting. So this is going to be a chapter in the book, not just solid-state lighting. The chapter will be about new uses in silver and where we see the future of silver on the industrial side. And there's also silver batteries, which, you know, this is not really a forecast, but something to pay attention to. And this is, you know, the electric car. I think the electric car is here to stay. I'm a good friend of Mike Maloney's, as you probably know, and we have the fun of driving Mike's Tesla. Last time I was visiting him in Los Angeles, and those things accelerate. Wow. But my point is these lithium-ion batteries that Tesla's manufacturing and others for these electric cars, you know, there is a silver substitute. I think at some point you may see silver lead or silver zinc or silver something battery that may be better than a lithium-ion, as far as better meaning, you know, longer range, more capacity, that type of thing. As far as weight, I'm not too sure. It'd probably be heavier, but not necessarily, you know, for the amount of juice getting out. Nothing conducts electricity as well as silver. And, of course, all of it's recyclable. In other words, the lithium ions are recyclable batteries, and silver would obviously be recyclable as well. So there's a lot of potential uses for silver that aren't, you know, right in your face at this point in time, but they're out there kind of lurking around, if you will. And some of them are very significant, such as what I mentioned, although may never come to fruition. It's possible it could. So we address that in the chapter. And, of course, the other things we're looking at is what investor sentiment is. And sentiment is what we just spent most of the show on. You know, when no one wants it, that's when you want it. When everybody wants it, that's when you don't want it. And that's going to be, I think, the hardest thing for me is 3 or 4 years from now, 2016 or 17, that's my current forecast, when everybody and his brother's calling me and saying, you know, I want to get your subscription. Dealer has silver. I can't find it here in Ohio. I can't find it in Florida. And, you know, that type of thing. And it's like, I don't look at it. Is it overvalued or not? Even silver can be overvalued. And it's not how many paper dollars silver's worth. It's how much does silver buy relative to other commodities? It's really the way to look at it. And when it's overvalued, I'm going to say, you know what? It's overvalued. I'm not afraid to pull the gun. In fact, one of the chapters in the book is about how to exit the market. We've had, I think it's like 5 or 6 strategies on how to exit the market. And, you know, it's investing is really about buying right. Selling isn't really an issue if you buy right. Of course, a lot of people will hold too far because they think it's going to go to the moon, and nothing, even the silver market, doesn't go to the moon.
David Morgan, I know there's listeners scratching their heads saying the silver investor is better connected than I am, has been in this industry for decades. Give us some sentiment indications. Let's say the silver ETF ownership and holdings. Interest levels very low there. What else are you looking at to kind of give you a gauge, a metric, to know that people have just tossed in the towel?
I'd say ETFs is a good place because these are the big purchasers. We look at, you know, the real silver bulls for the last decade or so. You look at the Sprott Physical Silver Trust. You look at Central Fund of Canada. You look at Zurich Continental Bank. Look at the SLV, you will find that there's no new purchases there. And there's several reasons for it. So the main reason is low prices. Now, that contradicts what I just said. Most of these guys are savvy enough to buy low. The problem is these are funds, and for them to buy low, they have to have a premium in the fund. And for most of them, there isn't enough of a premium to go ahead and float an offering to get enough money to go out and buy physical silver. So for them, it's sort of a catch-22. So that's one of those things that I'm looking at. We just get up off the bottom here. I think that you may see one come, and it's a little bit of a copycat industry, meaning that if you see one of those major funds or holding companies come in and make a substantial silver purchase, I wouldn't be surprised to see a couple more come in shortly thereafter, meaning within 2, 3, 4 months. And also make it. And if there were substantial purchases, like we've seen in the past, you know, 20 million ounces here, 30 million ounces there, that type of thing, All of a sudden, you might see a little bit more momentum in the silver market. And there's a shelf filing on most of these things. So these shelf filings are already filed with the SEC that basically says anytime they want to float an offering, it will. They'll put it out in the public domain, and you'll know about it about as quick as me. And then if I get whispered the number, let's say I have a call with John Emery, which I talk to John on a fairly regular basis, you know, I'm not allowed at law to tell even my members early. You know, I have to wait for it to be public information. So that's something that I can't really do. But no, I look more sentiment to me kind of goes with the market. I'm not a pure technician nor a pure fundamentalist. But if all of a sudden you start to see a lot of money moving in the silver market for no apparent reason, usually that means somebody knows something that perhaps even I don't. And if I saw that, obviously I'd get on the phone and start calling calls, and I might find out. In fact, in most cases, probably 80% of the time I would. But again, it was like Zurich Continental Bank and Eric Mayer over there was buying. He might even tell me, but I'm not allowed to say that until it becomes public domain knowledge. So that would be a situation that, you know, by being a member, you really wouldn't have a super advantage on.
Fundamentals obviously haven't really changed much, have they, over the past decade? I mean, sure, we had a sell-off from 2011 through 2013. But if gold went to a new nominal high in 2011, why is it that silver didn't run to a new nominal high? And should we be discouraged by that fact, or should we be now encouraged by it that it is inevitable, could represent, at least on a inflation-adjusted level, an interesting target to shoot for in the years to come?
First of all, the last decade, fundamentally, silver was about 35% of the market was for industrial use 10 years ago. Now it's about 55%. So industrial usage over the last decade has actually increased significantly. And again, we go into that in the book. Secondly, one of the things that's really important for people to know, and it seems to be misread by many silver aficionados, and that is that the production of silver increased during that same 10-year time frame. And it's like any commodity or anything in the market that's wanted badly. There's something that's wanted there, and the price is going to be profitable. There's going to be that demand that's going to drive up the supply. So the supply of silver rose significantly in the same 10-year time frame. Why didn't it make a nominal new high? Well, there's no one knows the answer to that, really. We did get to the nominal, you know, 50-ish level. But again, that's a nominal price. 50 today certainly is not much less valuable than 50 back in 1980. However, I think it has to do a lot with what goes on in this market, how much of momentum there was. I mean, they put five margin upgrades or increases in margin, I should say, while it was going up. The market was going parabolic. There's a lot of reasons on both arguments on why it was done. So there was lots of, let's say, impetus to keep the market around that level or lower. And of course, it was successful. So I don't look at it as, I got that question very much at that time frame. But it's over when it's over. And it's not over. In fact, I'll be speaking in about a week at the Money Show in San Francisco. And the title of my speech will be Precious Metals the Next 3 Years. Yeah, I'm not a big Elliott Wave guy, but I've studied markets my whole life. And basically, there's three moves up for any major market. And we've had two, and we've got one to go. And the last one is usually the one, the big one, the one that people like, if you're old enough to remember what Intel stock looked like in its heyday. I mean, it just keeps going up and up and up, and no one wants to get off. And this is what's going to happen, in my view, in the precious metals. But I'm not looking for that kind of move until 2016. But when it happens, there'll be more and more and more people coming in. But then there'll be that last buyer, and there will be no one to sell to, like all markets, like the technology boom, like the real estate bubble. And I think it'll be the bubble of all bubbles. I think it'll be compounded because of the synergistic effect. I think you're going to see the metals being held strongly in strong hands and added to by weaker hands come in the market. And at the same time, we're going to be having a semi or total debt crisis. So as people want out of bond markets, and this is across the board, not only government bonds, but municipal bonds, junk bonds, corporate bonds, there's going to be a lot of worry about what debt's good and what debt isn't. and they'll be seeking safe haven status, and that means gold primarily, but silver will be the spillover market. It's so tiny, and silver is priced less than gold, it'll push silver to new highs in real terms. So that's what I'm looking for, Chris. I'm not that concerned about it. You know, I said it would happen in my lifetime. It's still going to be a bit of a grind here. You know, it's not going to be happy days are here again, in my view, until sometime, probably the latter part of 2015. But you can make a lot of money being a prudent fundamental investor at this point in time while we're doing your show, averaging in now, and just having a long range view, meaning a long range nowadays is, you know, 3 to 5 years. So again, I think this is the time. Nobody wants it. You should want it.
I think it's well said. And, you know, where are the alternatives? I was, you know, talking to Bill Murphy last week and other guests recently. I mean, the way that the interest rates are set up, retirees, young folks, we're all in the same boat together, aren't we? I mean, there's just nowhere to hide. You can't beat inflation with almost any investment today. You know, you have this opportunity to get at gold and particularly silver, vastly discounted prices, and you can't park your wealth capital almost anywhere else to compensate for inflation better than precious metals. I think you've done a good job outlining some of the highlights that we should expect. Maybe you'd like to tell folks more about the Morgan Report.
If you want free information, you can go to our website, themorganreport.com. There's a free e-letter that comes out every Saturday. You can get that for free. If you're more inclined to get money, metals, and mining, over on the right-hand side, subscribe to our 3 levels of service. Also, for freebies, there is a YouTube channel called Silver Guru and a Twitter feed at Silver Guru.
You did kind of allude to 2016. I wonder if you could just add a few details here, give us an idea of what's so special, according to your work, about this time frame. I mean, is this political? Is this the changing of the guard? Or is there something else that you're seeing? Is it cyclical? Do you see a cycle top coming in when you add in the Elliott wave analysis?
The Elliott wave, again, I'm not a big fan of the Elliott wave theory, but no, it's more or less educated guess, knowing how markets move. This last leg up, once it gets going, it goes parabolic and stays there for probably months. And if you take a look at what the NASDAQ did, you get a pretty good idea of what I expect in the metals, or even the housing index during the rise up into 2007. Again, you'll get a pretty good idea of what I expect. The commodity cycle is usually a 17-year cycle average. So if you take 2000 for gold and add 17, you come out with 2017. A friend of mine wrote a book that got out an award called Polar Perspectives. And in that book, I think his date was in 2017. I didn't go along, you know, I'm saying that he agrees with me or I agree with him, but, that's my best wag right now. And I'll just call it a wag. But, normally when you get the spike high that we got, from the 1948 we discussed on your show, it usually takes at least 2 years, usually three, to consolidate. We've been a little longer than 3 years. Consolidation should be nearing an end. And then it takes a good year or so to come back up into the range where it was getting frothy, which, pick a number, 35, 40, I don't know. So looking a year out, we'd put you in 2015 in the summer. Maybe it'll be in the 40 range. Maybe in the 50. And of course, I have to put in a caveat I always do, Chris, which is that, you know, barring some huge geopolitical event, which could send the metals up, you know, instantly overnight, but barring that taking place, that's what I expect.
All right, David Morgan, we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Well, Harry S. Dent Jr. is head of an economic research and forecasting company and author of The Demographic Cliff. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
You know, I'd like to begin the discussion today with a lot of interesting geopolitical issues facing the globe. One of the things that come to mind, I think, obviously, is the Russia-Ukraine drama. Initially, this didn't catch, I think, the mainline media as particularly concerning, but that's changing. I'd like your thoughts on how this could impact the markets and the global economy.
Well, you know, first, Chris, back in early 2006, I added a cycle to my demographic and other cycles, which I call the geopolitical cycle. The markets tend to be favorable geopolitically for about 18 years and then unfavorable. And since 9/11, we've had just one geopolitical disaster after the next. You know, the Iran and Iraq wars and Syria civil war and the Arab Spring. And now it is focused on Russia and Ukraine and, of course, Israel and Gaza. This is a cycle that continues to point down for the next 5 or 6 years. So we're only going to see more of this, and I do not think any of these problems are over. And the markets tend to be valued at about half, you know, the price-earnings ratios when this cycle is down. So I hear a lot of pundits saying, oh, the markets are not that overvalued at 70 times earnings. No, it's extremely overvalued, given these geopolitical risks, and there's no end to any of these from what we see.
You know, it's interesting you should point that out. How much further could the equities rally really go? 10%, 20%? At some point, there has to be an aha moment where people recognize the fact that we've been running on fumes for so long that there has to be a reckoning day. You did mention the Middle East, and I think this is also, it's a hot button issue. It could escalate out of control. I mean, we have in Iraq. I mean, that's obviously going to be a problem. And then, as you mentioned, you know, Gaza has been trouble, and it's just getting worse. How do we factor this in, you know, into our function? How do we prepare as investors for what could be, you know, an Archduke Ferdinand-style moment down the road leading to a global issue? Is there something that investors can do, precautions we can take, contingencies that can be made?
Again, I think you're right. The market has, I say, more like 5% upside potential and 65% in the next few years on the downside. So it's a huge imbalance. And it means investors should just be cautious. They should be pulling out of stocks on every rally. Geopolitical events are a risk, but the bigger risk is from demographic factors. Demographics continue to point down much more strongly in the U.S. starting in 2015 and starting this year in countries like Germany and Europe. It gets worse. So basically, we don't see anything pointing up. Demographic factors point down. Geopolitical. I even recently added in my newsletter what I call a 45-year innovation cycle. I mean, like steamships just like peaked in their momentum in 1875 and then fell off, and then railroads in 1920 and automobiles in 1965 were finally 80% of households had one, and now the internet. So every cycle we look at says, look out. Yes, we've been in a long boom since 1983. It's been goosed by artificial stimulus, which never lasts and is never real. And, yeah, we have a lot more downside than upside. So investors should not be listening to the pundits who say, oh, yeah, the stock market's okay, and the Fed's got our back on the economy. The Fed has stretched things way beyond what anybody would have thought, and it only creates more downside. They're only putting off, like you said, the inevitable kind of reset or reckoning that has to come from the greatest debt and financial bubble in modern history.
Let's talk about demographics for a moment, but not from our traditional discussions here with you on the show, but let's add another component. You know, the late and very interesting Michael Rupert met an untimely demise. He had, I think, an interesting take on demographics. He liked to look at it in the context, okay, of peak oil. You know, I think it's interesting that this really does seem to work well with your thesis, demographic trends, because his concern was with finite amount of oil, which of course is supposedly declining due to peak oil, that could not work well in any way, and I'm putting it euphemistically, with demographics. Eventually, you reach this breaking point where there just isn't enough of this natural resource to sustain the lifestyle that the Western world has come to love and to export that lifestyle to China and many other peripheral nations. I'd like your thoughts.
We see oil prices heading down. Commodity prices peak about every 30 years, 1950, 1980. And they peaked back in mid-2008. They rallied into 2011, and they're still heading more down, and I think oil is heading down. So oil is a factor, and it is a limitation, but I think the weakness in the global economy is going to weaken oil prices, and we have become less dependent on oil because of fracking, which has its ups and downsides, but you know, I don't see that as the biggest impediment going forward. It has been a big one in the past. But I tell people I don't want to be investing in the oil producing nations in the Middle East, because not only do they have huge geopolitical problems, basically civil wars everywhere, but they have falling oil prices to deal with, and I think they are going to fall to $20, give or take, in the next decade.
Well, another analyst, unfortunately, who recently passed away suddenly, but one of the top analysts in the area we had on the show somewhat regularly, Matthew Simmons, pointed out that when he visited the wells in the Middle East, they required the injection of massive amount of salt water to facilitate the removal of the remaining oil. And he said this is indicative of wells that will run dry in the next decade. So in other words, their reserves, in-ground reserves, were very, very low relative to some of the other newer. But let's move on now then to the precious metals. For the most part, gold still up over 5% for the year. I'd like your take on the prospects here. Are we still going to continue in this bear following the 2011 peak? Was it just too frothy at that point? Or do you see signs of a bottom here for gold and silver?
I do see gold prices and silver going down lower, same reasons as oil. It's just a general deflation in the global economy and a slowing. But, it did get oversold around 1180 not too long ago, and it is bouncing. And gold's kind of a wild card because it's going to benefit from these geopolitical factors, but it's not going to benefit from the deflationary and slowdown forces. So I'm looking at gold probably rallying back to 1350, 1360 or so. Then I would call it a question mark. But it is a wild card because of geopolitical events. And I don't think this is the time to be skeptical of gold. But I think as time goes on, if the economy does slow down as I forecast, then it will affect all commodities, not just gold.
Okay, well, I'd like to get into those geopolitical points in a moment. I'd also like to ask you this. When you talk about deflation, and we've discussed this many times in the past, I think we have to take a look at, the ECB, for instance, which is still holding rates at the lowest level, just lowered it to the lowest point. Now, let's harken back to the 1970s, when rates were just incredibly low in the late 60s, early 70s. So you don't think this time we're going to go from a near zero or zero interest rate level into a similar 1970s period, just quite the opposite? You see almost a 1930s style or 1920s style deflationary environment. Can you contrast and compare the two and let us know how you see this unfolding?
Chris, one of the things we look at history is the economy for hundreds of years now has gone through a cycle. It used to be called the Kondratieff wave. But it's mild inflation boom and then a high inflation season, usually with wars like the 70s, and then disinflation and then a winter season with deflation. The economy's never gone any other direction. So we saw that, spring boom in the 1950s and 60s. We saw the summer inflation that really was great for gold and silver and commodities in the 70s and early 80s. And then we've seen a disinflationary bubble boom, which always happens in the fall. But always following that bubble boom is a deflation, a restructuring of debt and financial assets that, yes, even though governments are printing money without abandon, the restructuring of such massive debt destroys money, financial bubbles burst, which started to happen in 2008, and of course governments have reflated to fight that, always ends up in deflation. Unless this is the first time that doesn't happen, then that's our view, is that we're going to see deflation, and then you will see an inflationary environment again, but only after you've had that kind of reset. And again, it's the economy's never gone any other way. You don't go from a fall bubble boom season back to an inflationary summer season. You only go into deflation or winter.
Let's talk about Argentina, the Weimar Republic. Let's talk about Central Europe for a 50-year period following World War II, where governments just find no other option but printing a massive amount of money. And now it's much easier than it was in the past. Doesn't even require a printing press. What is going to keep our officials, our global central bankers, from pulling the same rabbit out of the hat pumping up the system full of digital ones and zeros to keep the status quo, to keep the deflationary moment, a 1929, 1931, 32 style economic depression from unfolding. Don't you think that they'll follow the Keynesian model that they have now for nearly a century?
Yeah, no, they will. And I've been surprised at how far they've gone in the last several years. But they're fighting demographic and debt trends that are far greater. I mean, the Fed is, you know, has created like $3 trillion in money. Well, that sounds like a lot, but compared to the size of the economy and compared to the total money supply, it's only a tiny fraction. So they can only impact so much. They have marginally kept us growing at 2% with 1 to 2% inflation with massive money printing. Now, if they had printed this much money in the 80s or the 70s or any other time when there were more inflationary trends, it would have been catastrophic. And Germany did this in the early 20s. You know, they lost World War One, and then they were saddled with reparations on top of that. They had to print massive amounts of money, but that's an isolated thing, Argentina and stuff. We've never seen major countries like Europe, you know, in Europe or United States, be able to create hyperinflation simply from money printing. In fact, in the 1970s, the Fed was fighting inflation, as you said. It wasn't the Fed causing inflation. They were fighting it. It was the baby boom, you know, massive drain on the economy, a bunch of young people, you know, spending their parents' money, not producing anything, the lowest productivity in the last century had a lot to do with that inflation. In fact, I've got an indicator that predicts workforce growth and predicts when you'll see higher inflation with lots of young people or disinflation with older people. So aging not only affects our spending habits, it affects inflation. And the aging of the baby boom, they're just going to downsize houses, spend less, save more. This is not inflationary for the next decade. After, you know, the next generation will bring it back, but you know, that's another factor. So I don't see inflation coming back en masse, and it's certainly not. I mean, look at Europe. They've been stimulating for years. They got zero inflation. Japan's been stimulating for two decades almost. No inflation, zero. So if anybody says printing money has to cause inflation, then you got to look at reality and say, nope, not in this era.
But back to inflation, I agree with you at one level. I agree with you if we just look at the nominal statistics that the BLS and the government are throwing out there. But, you know, if we drill down into the actual inflation figures, if we compose our own indexes, you start to realize that the numbers just don't add up. I mean, that people are paying substantially more for everyday goods and services. And now, of course, you know, there's 300 million everyday Americans who can tell you that.
Well, I agree with Chris on that. Energy and food, yes. But look at housing. What's the biggest expenditure of the everyday household? It's housing. Mortgage rates are at record lows. Housing has fallen 20 to 30% from its peak, and I think it's going to go down further in the next few years. So housing is deflating, and it's huge. So overall, I think they don't really properly state inflation figures. They're understating some things, overstating others. But I think overall, we don't have major inflation. And again, despite unprecedented money printing, I mean, it's got to cause anybody to say, what's going on? Theory is they're inflating to fight deflation. So deflation is the bigger trend.
It's interesting. And there's definitely plenty of empirical evidence to support the idea. However, let's not ignore another component here that gets very little traction. Once again, where is all the money that's been printed?
It's in the stock market. It's all gone into financial assets. In other words, we are getting inflation, but the money is going into financial assets because it has nowhere else to go. Bonds have been falling in value, commodities, even gold and silver, of all things, in a time like this. And so investors keep getting pushed into the stock market, and they're going to go over a huge cliff ahead. People are basically committing suicide by jumping into the stock market saying, well, where else am I going to get yield? Because everybody's doing the same thing. They're buying stocks. Our worst place to be right now. The Fed is giving them no choice. And I mean, you know, Janet You know, I got criticized in my newsletter for making fun of Janet Yellen. I'm like, no. You think Wall Street's a bunch of Boy Scouts? You push interest rates to zero, hedge funds lever up 30 to 50 times and speculate like crazy, and then markets like oil in 2008, oil fell 82% in 4 months from speculation. And that's what the stock market is. It's just gone up, 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 up. Most of it's stock buybacks, low interest rates is not real. It's not real growth. The economy's not healthy. It's growing at only 2% on average with the most massive stimulus program in all of modern history. Something's wrong here, and people are piling into stocks.
It's an accident looking for a place to happen. Okay, we have a beautiful expression here on the left, but there's an equation. How do we balance this equation? Well, we need to know what will be the bull markets of the future to balance this out. Because obviously, there's going to be a huge global sea change shift in capital. The only thing that comes to my mind, at least the first thing, you know, the U.S. dollar. People are going to be clamoring for liquidity at some point if we start to talk about deflation. Tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you look at the last crisis when things really melted down in late 2008, the U.S. dollar went up 27% versus other currencies because it is kind of the last hedge against a crisis. And I only see a crisis that I don't see any other resolution. Governments are going to stimulate. They're in denial. People, investors and people are in denial. We're going to have a crisis to balance out this massive debt and massive financial bubbles. And once that happens, there will be huge, I mean, lifetime bargains in financial assets, from real estate to stocks to gold to commodity. I mean, it'll just, in fact, the next boom that we see starting about 6 to 10 years from now with the millennial generation and emerging countries, you know, their middle classes, this next boom will be very commodity intensive because it will be driven more by emerging countries. And they consume much more commodities. I mean, China and India are the biggest consumers of gold in the world. And India is going to have one of the greatest booms in history when we get on the other side of this. But you have to have this reset first. So I'm just telling investors, look, stand back, you know, either short stocks if you're brave or just be in cash and let the next crash happen and then look at the opportunities in like healthcare related industries in the U.S. and Europe and in emerging countries, particularly countries like India and Mexico that are not as sensitive to commodity prices. While that cycle is still down, and I mean, there will be huge opportunities for investment, but you got to let the crisis happen first. And there's no magic cure to this, especially now that governments have overstimulated. We're just going to have a huge crisis, and governments are going to fail. Despite, they are going to keep stimulating. You're right about that. They're not going to stop doing this. They are tapering now, just when the baby boomers are set to hit their next big demographic decline, and they're not aware of that. But it doesn't matter. China's going to blow, biggest bubble in the world. Germany is failing. We've been predicting this over the last year. Their statistics keep coming out weaker. They have the worst demographic trends of any single country over the next decade. And Europe is relying on Germany to hold up the European Union. Good luck. Super bullish because of the baby boom, and now the baby boom's done spending, and we've got this unbelievable debt bubble and financial bubble that the government's only making worse, only sustaining. And when it fails, you look back at history, when debt bubbles and financial bubbles burst, it is always horrible. I mean, it's what happens. There's no good ending to a bubble like this.
What I hear is you need to avoid housing like the plague because now that we've just blown another mini bubble, let's call it mini 2.0. So we've had quite a rebound over the past 3 or 4 or 5 years. And, you know, it looks tenuous in the HGX housing market index. I mean, we might end up back where we were, couldn't we, in the late, say, mid-90s in housing or even earlier.
That's what we're looking at, Chris, that bubbles go back to where they started or a little lower. And this bubble started in January of 2000, so I'm looking for real estate to go back at a minimum to January 2000 prices and at worst 1996 to 97 prices. That's another 40% down on average from here.
Well, that was my question. You know, can you put a percentage on it?
We're going to see a bigger decline than we saw the first time around. Same thing with stocks. Stocks, you know, crashed 50-some percent last time. I think they're going to crash 65% plus the next round.
Let's put stocks in abeyance for a moment, and let's just finish that thought. You know, you talk about up to a 40% decline. That's really quite a substantial statement. And remember the mountain of subprime, Alt-A, toxic loans we had to work our way through between 2006 and, let's say, 2012. Well, we've done that now. We've cleared most of that through the system. You're saying there's another specter here that we haven't prepared for?
Yeah, you know, it's just like the stock market. The Fed has, with super low interest rates, has caused a modest recovery in housing, which wouldn't have happened otherwise because the baby boomers are done buying homes. They peaked, you know, back in the early, you know, mid-2000s on home buying. We predicted that in September 2005 that the bubble was peaking. People thought we were crazy. Housing can never go down. There's an endless, you know, demand against limited supply, and it went down. But it didn't. The Fed did not let housing shake out as much as it would have. They bailed it out, like they bailed everything out, and they bailed out stocks and got stocks to bubble again. So we have to have another round. We won't be over this bubble until stocks go back to early 2000 prices or below, and housing goes back to them. We have to reset the bubble. And nobody wants that to happen because it's going to be painful for the banks, painful for investors, especially bondholders and stockholders and stuff and real estate owners and stuff. But it has to happen because if we don't reset, the next generation is never going to be able to invest for retirement, never be able to afford a home. And so this is necessary, but it will be painful.
Well, it will be painful, but I think you make a really important point here, and that is, look, it's going to make prices more affordable. I mean, why are we fighting?
That's a good long-term thing. High real estate is only bad for an economy. It raises the cost of business, raises the cost of living. So the only people that want real estate to keep going up are the people that already own it, which is aging baby boomers. The young generation should be praying for home prices to come down because they've yet to buy their homes.
Exactly. And if we look at Professor Shiller's work on the housing index going back roughly 100 years, it really shows what I think you'd agree to be, for the most part, a phenomenally stable trend. It's not even a trend. It's just a almost like a horizontal asymptote.
Yeah. Actually, if you it goes housing long term goes up with inflation, which has been on average 3%. Now it gets higher and lower, and it's lower now, and it was higher in the 70s. But it goes up with inflation. In other words, if you adjust for inflation, historically what Shiller has shown is that housing is not an appreciating asset. Mm-hmm. People shouldn't be buying housing for appreciation. They should buy it because they want to live in it. They should buy it because they want to rent it out to business or consumers. So we've got a huge misunderstanding of real estate, and Shiller did great work.
But, you know, I would argue that it's not a misunderstanding, that it's really a function of people intuitively recognizing, look, I've got to game the system to win here. They're learning my dollar doesn't hold its value. Purchasing power is evaporating. And so they're running to whatever might just, you know, make them enough money to keep things going. And obviously, this is going to be something that our officials are going to have to contend with in a big way in the years going forward. All right. Well, we've covered, I think, most of the bases. Why don't you tell folks more about the services you provide, please?
Yeah. We have a free daily newsletter at harrydent.com. It's called The Economy and Markets. And then at dentresearch.com, we have, you know, a whole wealth of information about all the newsletters and services that we provide. And this is a time to listen to somebody who's got a different opinion from my point of view. The normal economists are clueless on what's going on here.
Well, you definitely have a unique perspective that we don't run into from most of our guests here on GoldSeek.com Radio. Harry S. Dent Jr., we appreciate your thoughts.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A report issued this week by the United States Conference of Mayors cited that while 8.7 million jobs have been regained since the 2008 economic collapse, those jobs are paying much less, an average of 23% less. The president of the Conference of Mayors, Kevin Johnson, said, "While the economy is picking up steam, income inequality and wage gaps are an alarming trend that must be addressed." He said, we cannot put our heads in the sand on these issues. What he cites as income inequality is the annual wage in sectors where jobs were lost, like manufacturing and construction, where during the recession it was $61,637, but the average wage of new jobs through the second quarter of 2014 is now reduced to $47,131, according to this week's report. This change represents a loss of $93 billion in wages, according to the Conference of Mayors report. The losses documented in construction and manufacturing were replaced with jobs in hospitality, health care, and administrative support. The mayor's report shows the gap between low and higher income households is growing and likely will continue in the future. In 2012, 73% of metro areas had a larger share of poorer households, those making less than $35,000 a year, than upper-income households making over $75,000. One dynamic of this report is that several categories of older, higher-paying jobs are being replaced with newer categories of lower-paying jobs. New job creation establishes a higher standard of living baseline for individuals and families at a level that is much less than what people were previously used to. Couple that with the significant yet unacknowledged inflation we have experienced since 2008, and the average person and family is already many steps behind the proverbial eight ball. Unacknowledged, masked, hidden inflation that eats away and destroys one standard of living like a virulent strain of flesh-eating bacteria, coupled with new jobs that position people at a lower starting point from the get-go, reflect an economic double whammy that remains invisible to most people. Most people accept the official inflation numbers, and most are happy just to get a job. That most refuse to run the numbers and look reality square in the eye and see how bad it really is. The survival of the current big lie depends on how long people will tolerate phony inflation numbers and pretend that a job, any job, is enough to maintain their standard of living. At some point, something is going to give. The periodic cry in the media for things like fast food workers to have a $15 an hour minimum wage isn't an outlandish suggestion. It's a cry for help, for wage inflation to be allowed to enter the equation, to catch people up to a point where their wages will support a basic lifestyle that has been ravaged by unacknowledged inflation. But allowing wage inflation would be like allowing gold to inflate and reflect its true market value. It would set off alarm bells throughout the market. And those kinds of alarm bells are something they will fight and suppress until they no longer can. And in the meantime, we will all suffer. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.